Good morning. A couple of things before we get into our lesson this morning. First of all, I need to turn to John chapter 2. John chapter 2, we'll be looking at verses 1 through 11. John chapter 2, 1 through 11. One of the things that we are going to be looking at in the future, next Sunday evening, is some questions concerning the Gospel of John. You might the challenge is that everybody read the Gospel of John through 12 times during 2012. So if you're on schedule, you should have read through the Gospel of John at least once, probably. If you haven't, you'll catch back up, no problem. But some questions have been raised. Some people want to know, how do we know it's John, and what's the timing, and how does it fit with the other Gospels and things like that. And so we're going to spend one of our evenings when we deal with Bible questions, dealing with those kinds of questions from the Gospel of John. That'll be next Sunday evening, so be sure and make a mental note of that and join us for that. And then I have an announcement that I didn't get from my wife in time to put in the bulletin, and then I forgot to give it to Akel, so I'm in the doghouse. That's one reason maybe I'm wearing her daring tie that she made me wear today. Saturday, February 25th, everyone needs to mark that at 4 p.m. in the fellowship hall, there is a baby shower to welcome Molly. And so you need to put that down. Christine has some gift ideas from Christy if you are interested, if you want to talk to her about that, or, you know, Christy's here, you can talk to her yourself. That's the 25th, Saturday the 25th at 4 p.m. in the fellowship hall for everybody who would like to be a part of that. I think that means ladies. I'm not sure that the guys are supposed to be a part of that, so, you know. Okay, John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. Follow along as I read. John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding, and when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were set there six water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now, and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it, and when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You have kept the good wine until now." This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. All right, let's stop right there. John is writing as if he wants to make certain we understand that there is more involved than the simple statement of facts that are here. And I think that's important for us to remember. Remember, our scripture reading was from John chapter 20, verses 30 and 31. And it reminds us that John records everything that he records after having picked them out on purpose. And he picks them out of a number of things that he could have picked out. In fact, there are so many things he could have picked out that John's book could not have even held at all if he had just done one-liners. But he picks these out on purpose. And what John does is John records for us eight different miracles in his account. And in his gospel, these eight miracles that Jesus performs are unique. They're pretty unique to the telling of the life of Jesus. The first one here is here in chapter 2 with water being turned into wine. The second one is going to be found in chapter 4 with the healing of the nobleman's son. The third one will be in chapter 5 when it's the curing of the paralyzed man. In chapter 6, there are two. There is the feeding of the 5,000 and there is the walking on the Sea of Galilee during a storm. In chapter 9, there is the sixth one, which is the giving sight to the man who is born blind. In chapter 11, there's the seventh one, which is the resurrection of Lazarus. In chapter 8, there is one more, and that is the chapter where Jesus provides fish for the nets of the disciples. And of course, you could make a case that there is actually a ninth one, and that is the resurrection itself, which I think is probably a good one to do. But there's no duplication in these. There's no duplication in presenting these, but they all have the same purpose. And the same purpose, the purpose is identified here in verse 11. This is the beginning of signs Jesus did in Canaan of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. John's whole purpose in writing his gospel is to bring people to believe. And you come to belief in Jesus, come to a saving belief in Jesus, when you understand that he is God. God in the flesh. God who comes in order to build that stairway, that pathway to God, to the Father, to rescue us, to redeem us, to take on the sins of the world. Things which we have already talked a little bit about and alluded to. And Christ manifests his glory for the first time here in this event. But now as we look at chapter 2 by way of a little outline, we come to the real formal part of the book. From chapter 2 to chapter 12 is the public ministry of Jesus to the Jews. Just those chapters, 2 through 12, the public ministry of Jesus. From chapter 13 to 17, there is no public ministry. There is a private ministry with the disciples. And he calls out his disciples in chapters 2 to 12. He takes them aside in chapters 13 to 17 to get them ready because he's going away. Then in chapter 18 through 20, he leaves. Then in chapter 21, he returns and he urges them to their new role in the coming kingdom. And so here today, we are looking at the very beginning of his public ministry. And as we arrive at the first miracle that he ever performed, his first public act to reveal his true glory, his true identity, there are several things that we need to notice in the text. We need to notice the scene. We need to notice the situation. We need to notice the supply, and we need to notice the significance. And I'm sorry, but you know, that's a habit of preachers. You do things all with the same letter, you know. So this is the letter S today. Kind of feel like Sesame Street, you know. Today's lesson is brought to you by the letter S. But anyway, first of all, notice the scene in verse 1, okay? The third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee. All right? Now, what is the third day referring to? One of the things we need to keep track of is that John does a good job of giving us time clues. And what he does is he goes all the way back into chapter 1 to the time when John had been confronted by priests and Levites who are saying who want to know, who are you? Why are you doing the things that you're doing? And John tells them that he is the one who's the forerunner of the Messiah. And then the next day, Jesus returns from his temptation in the wilderness. The next day after that, you have John standing with two of his disciples, they begin following him. The following day, they want to go with him to Galilee. And now on the third day, well, the third day is not the third day from the appearance of the Jews who are testing John, but it's the third day from the following day when they traveled with him to Galilee. It's telling us that they left the area down by the Jordan River where they were, and they walked all this way, they traveled all the way up to Nazareth. And it's about a 2 or 3 day journey. But it's also telling us that by this third day, they've actually gone to another city, the city of Cana. Now, Galilee and Cana are right next to one another. Cana is a little village that is right next to Nazareth, very near to Nazareth. In fact, some of the old writers say that you could see Cana on a clear day from the city of Nazareth. It was only about 8 miles away, just a little village. Nazareth was a town where Jesus had lived his 30 years. All of his family were there, his sisters, his brothers, his relatives. But Cana is almost considered a suburb in terms of how cities were back then, of Nazareth. And they arrive in Cana of Galilee 3 days after they have set on their trip from the Jordan River to Galilee. They now arrive at Cana. And when they arrive there, the second part of verse 1 tells us something more about the scene. It tells us that the mother of Jesus was there. Now, of course, that's Mary. She's never identified by name in this scene. And it isn't strange that she would be at a wedding because, as I said, this is kind of a suburb town in a sense. And it's very probable from the way she interacts with the servants and the people that are at this wedding that she knew these people. In fact, it may be that they were related. There is a tradition that there is a definite family relationship here in some form or fashion. We don't know exactly what. It's just tradition. The text never tells us. But nevertheless, Mary is there, and surely it was at least as being friends of the family of Jesus, if not some relative. And then, as they're there, something happens that sets the stage for the miracle. You see, what was happening was that they were having a wedding, and the disciples are invited to go along with Jesus, and they're all there. It's almost like Jesus arrives back in his town of Nazareth. They see he's got disciples now, and they say, well, come on down to the wedding. The more the merrier. Bring your disciples. And they go down to the wedding. Now, there's something about weddings that we need to understand in the time period. In this time period, in this cultural setting, a wedding is a very big thing. In fact, it is the biggest thing going on in those days. It would be the biggest thing that would ever happen, most likely, in anybody's life when they got married. Because what would happen when they got married? The husband and wife would come together, there would be a ceremony, and then there would be a celebration. And this celebration isn't like the celebrations that we have at our weddings today. In our weddings today, we have a reception. In our weddings today, that reception can go from very simple, where you share a piece of cake, you know, and that's it, to having an elaborate meal with some sort of celebration afterwards, a band or whatever, you know. But still, in our day, it's usually just an evening event. That's it. In the day of Jesus, it wasn't an evening event. It was an event that took place that occupied days. It occupied days. And essentially, you would entertain practically the whole community during this celebration. And it would last anywhere from 2 to 7 days, depending upon how wealthy you were. And if you were really loaded, history records that there were some celebrations that went on for 2 weeks. Now, having two daughters, and they both got, you know, are married, and we've seen what happens at receptions and how much those type of things cost. I can't imagine paying for a celebration that lasts for 2 weeks, let alone 2 days, let alone, you know, I mean, that's just mind-boggling to me. But most of the time, it seems from the history that we can determine that most of the time, weddings ran about a week. And you just kind of said goodbye to your job. You dropped everything, all your worry about the crops, all the work you had piled up. You would drop your job and you just went over to the house and you had a great time for a week. In fact, the bride and bridegroom would have been betrothed to each other long before this, but they had never come to live together, but now they've been brought together to formalize the wedding, have a ceremony, and come to live together, and now they celebrate this with a very festive celebration. Fact is, some of the writings tell us that every night they would dress the bride and groom in special bridal robes. Depending on how wealthy you were, they might be different bridal robes for each night, and they would put them up on seats that could be carried above your head by a group of people, and they would actually light torches and parade them all through town, and then bring them back and set them down and have a feast. Evidently, not everybody went, because as they're traveling around, other people are setting up the feast, you know, and you come back, the feast is ready. And they would be treated like a king and a queen. And in a life where there was much poverty and much hard work and coarseness of life, this was a truly refreshing festival of joy and a time, really, which was the supreme occasion in most people's lives. Keep that in mind, because here in this wedding going on in Cana, it says in verse 2 that, in verse 3, that something happened. They ran out of wine. They ran out of wine. Now, in the bulletin today, there's an article. I found it quite by accident. It's written by a man who preaches in Abilene, Texas, for the Church of Christ there. He posted it late last night after I had the lesson all done, and he had some terrific points that I had not considered. So I used his article in our bulletin this morning. But in that article, he points out that there would be disastrous results or something running out during a wedding feast. Because you see, you were supposed to plan all of this out meticulously. You were supposed to make sure you had enough of everything to take care of the celebration. And if you ran out, it would cause a stigma that would stick with you for the rest of your married life. All right? And here is Jesus, and there's this situation that has come up. And Mary knows about it, and Mary comes to Jesus and says to him, "They have no wine." They have no wine. Now, you might say, well, you know, there are some people who will say, well, this isn't real wine. This is grape juice, isn't it? No, this is real wine that they're serving. In fact, back as far as Genesis 14 and verse 18, you'll find Melchizedek showing up with bread and wine. And you need to realize they didn't have the purification process, and that the water was a lot worse to drink than wine was. And in those parts of the world, when it was hot, in times of heat, they would need to have their thirst quenched, and you couldn't drink the wine, and I mean, you couldn't drink the water and without risking illness, and also they drank wine. Now, sometimes the wine would be mixed with milk. Sometimes it would be mixed with water. In fact, the common everyday drink was that there would be 3 parts water for every 2 parts of wine in order to eliminate the problem of drunkenness. But this is wine that is supposed to be served for a celebration. And very likely, even though there is a lot of condemnation about drunkenness and all of that in Scripture, it's very likely that we're talking about the kind of wine that is normal wine. Not even the watered down kind. But regardless of what it is, they are running out. Jesus has his mother come up and say, "They have no wine." Then verse 4. Now verse 4 is a statement. There are a couple of statements here that we really do not understand. Because look at what it says. In the New King James, it reads like this: "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Now that sounds harsh to our ears, no matter how you want to say it. I mean, you can make it with the softest voice possible. "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Or you can make it really, you know, to our ears it sounds horrible. It sounds like Jesus is being disrespectful. We need to understand that there is a little bit of a problem with translation and with usage. Now, the words are not a problem. The first word, "woman," is not a problem. That is what the word is in the Greek language. But we need to understand that in their culture, when you use the word woman, you weren't talking down at someone. You weren't belittling someone. You weren't even hinting at any type of disrespect. Rather, the word, as it's used in everyday language, this word specifically is like our English word lady. And even that is, you know, has a little bit of connotation in different terminologies or different contexts, because you can use the word lady in a context where you are being sarcastic and you're really saying, yeah, you aren't really a lady, are you? But I'm going to call you that. But generally, the word lady is a word that describes great respect. And Jesus is showing great respect to his mother. Now, I think there's a difference. I think that why there's something going on here. This is my opinion as to why he doesn't call her mother, because Jesus is in the stage of changing from being a dutiful son living at home to being on his mission. And so he's putting a little distance between them, but he's being respectful as he's doing it. He's saying, "Lady, my lady, my lady." Being respectful. But it's the next line also that lends it to being kind of harsh. It's translated, "What does your concern have to do with me?" In the Greek, the words are literally, "What is there for you and me?" That is literally what the words say. What is there for you and me? And depending on the context, you see, this was a fixed formula in the Greek. This was a particular way of saying something in the Greek language. And John is, I think, making a point that we don't get in our English very well, because we don't have anything that parallels it. And so we have a variety of ways that translators tackle this particular phrase. What is there for you and me? Some of them translate it and say, well, what do we have in common? You know? Some translations will say, well, what do we have in common? Other translations will say, now, what does this one says, what does your concern have to do with me? And almost like they're saying, like Jesus saying, this is your problem, not mine. That's kind of the way you would read it and understand it in this English translation. But there is a third way that this can be translated, or that this can be understood, and that is, this is not your concern, this is mine. What is there for you and me is a phraseology that generally is used to indicate partnership in something. And as it indicates partnership in something, it usually is used to describe or to ask the question, well, what's your part and what's my part? So that we can do this together. And that's why the translators go different ways. Are they going to go, is Jesus saying, well, there is no part in this for me? Or is Jesus saying there is no part in this for you? Well, considering that Jesus goes on and ends up doing something to help out, and considering it says that this was done deliberately, I'm inclined to think that Jesus is saying, there's nothing for you to worry about. My hour has not yet come is a phrase that is used all throughout John's Gospel to indicate that Jesus is always working on God's timetable. And I think what he was saying is that, Mary, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it when the time is right. And I think that's the way she understood it. I don't think she understood it in the way that we generally think, where we think that Jesus is saying, it's not my concern, it's yours. I think Jesus was saying, don't worry about it. I'll take care of it when the time is right. Because what does she do in the very next verse? In the very next verse it says, his mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Now what does that mean? It means that she must have understood what Jesus was saying had to have had a yes in it. Had to have had something in what he said that said, hey, look, he's going to take care of this situation. And so she acts on that belief and gets the servants ready. Now, John tells us about more of the scene. He says there were six water pots there. Now, six water pots is usually a great number for a particular house to have, because a house would usually have one or two or maybe three water pots to use in your normal everyday washing, because the washing, was the washing of purification. And they were done in a certain way, a certain prescribed way, and the water was that. There are six of them here because this is a wedding, and you've got a large group of people that have to be accommodated. And the pots contain between 20 and 30 gallons. Now, it tells us 20 or 30 gallons because evidently they're not uniform pots. Okay? One's probably 30 gallons, one's probably 20 gallons, you know, and they're not uniform because that's not the normal pot arrangement for this household. They brought in some extra pots from somewhere else to accommodate the crowd. And Jesus tells the servants, fill these water pots. And they fill them to the brim. Now, we don't know where they filled them. We don't know how they filled them. We don't know anything like that. We know that Cana has a well that's in the center of town, like most of the towns in this desert region. We know that they could have had a cistern. They could have had all kinds of things. They didn't have wells where you could pump a handle in and it would come out and, you know, just fill it up. If they had to go to the well to do it, they'd have to lower down a bucket, fill it up, bring it back up, haul it over and all that. Whatever it is, there's a great deal of effort that goes into this as they fill these six water pots. And in the end, you end up with somewhere between 120 and 180 gallons of water. And it emphasizes that they were filled to the brim. They filled them up. Now Jesus says in verse 8, draw some of that water out and take it to the man who is the master of the feast. See, one of the things that went on is that you had someone during one of these celebrations who oversaw everything. He was generally like the best man in today's celebrations, except that he oversaw making sure that all the food gets delivered right, all the seating arrangements are right, everything takes place when it's supposed to take place. This is the guy who's in charge of the feast. And so the translators translated master of the feast here. Some translations, some of the newer translations, might even put something like head waiter. That's not exactly right, because he's a little bit more than a head waiter, all right? But he's the guy in charge of seeing that everything gets done properly. He's generally a member of the household. He's generally somebody who's very concerned about the welfare of the bride and groom. So he's someone very close in the family relationship. And they draw some water out, they bring it to him, and the water has turned to wine. Now, he has no idea where this came from. He has no idea what's going on. He has nothing, no clue whatsoever as to anything miraculous taking place. He just simply makes a comment about how great and good tasting the wine is. But then John makes a point to tell us that the servants who had drawn the water knew. Now, I think there's a reason for John to say that. Because you see, when we get down to verse 11, it says that all of this took place as a means of manifesting His glory so that His disciples would believe in Him. But remember, His disciples are not the only ones who know about the water being turned to wine. There's also the servants. They actually have been involved much more than the disciples. These six men, which is all He's got at this point, they've been much more involved than these six men. The disciples see it all and know it all of what's happening. But these servants, they participated. And yet, the emphasis is, they didn't come to believe. They didn't come to believe. How could they miss the Messiah? How could they see a miracle like this and not see or understand who it was? I don't know. I have no answer. But there is a definite contrast being played here between the servants who knew what was going on and the disciples who have come to believe in Jesus. In many ways, I think it's just like the old story of Satan that we see all throughout the Scriptures. He's the god of this world. He blinds the minds around us so that they won't believe. And I think that's exactly what has happened to these servants. They have been blinded. They do not understand what's going on. And they do not come to faith. But why would John choose this as the first miracle to record? Other than the fact that it is the very first miracle that he performs, the text says, why would he use it as the first miracle to record? Because I believe John was hitting upon one of the basic things about becoming a follower, a believer of Jesus. We have to believe that he is God. Think about what has happened here. Think about what has happened here. Jesus has created wine from water. Now, in a sense, all wine is created from water, because all wine takes water into the vine of the grape plant. The water is used to grow the grapes. The grapes ripen on the vine. The vine, when it gets ripe, the grapes are harvested. Then they are crushed. Then they are stored and fermented, and then they are served. But what did Jesus do? Jesus short-circuited all of that, didn't he? There were no grapes. There were no vines. There was no harvesting. There was no crushing. There was no fermentation process. He did everything instantaneously. The miracle of the water turning to wine is one in which Jesus has totally eliminated all the natural processes and totally created something new out of something ordinary. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17, Paul makes this statement. He says, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creation. And the words there in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17, are words that describe the fact that Jesus has taken something ordinary and changed it to something new. New in terms of wonderful. New in terms of spectacular. New in terms of marvelous. New just like the water being changed to wine. And it's a miracle. It's a creative miracle that every Christian goes through. And John, as he's writing his gospel with the intent that he wants people to become Christians, talks to us at the very, picks this from all those things that Jesus could be used to talk about Jesus. And he says, this reminds me the most of the creative power of change that God can wrought in a person's life. And so he tells us about the wedding at Cana and the miracle of water into wine. So what do we do with this? Well, it's a miracle that we've got to see that can take place in every one of us. It's a miracle of grace, because Jesus was extending grace to this family who was in need. It's a miracle of supply. It's a miracle also of substance. And he's telling us that just like that, what happened at that wedding, it can happen in our lives. Jesus can take our lives, as ordinary as they are, and change them substantially. Change them completely. But only if we believe. In the New Testament, belief is always associated with obedience. Belief is always associated with also turning away from a pathway away from God and turning back to God. Belief is always, look at the book of Acts, associated with commitment that is exemplified in baptism into Jesus Christ. This morning, are you, if you're not a Christian, ready to make sure that you follow this one who is the Creator? Let Him recreate you. Create you anew. A new creation by being baptized into His death and raised to walk in newness of life. While together we stand and sing.